From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, some behind-the-scenes stories about classic rock and roll songs from the team that wrote them. Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller wrote Hound Dog, Jailhouse Rock, Yakety Yak, Stand By Me, and dozens more. Also today, John Leguizamo tells about creating his gallery of Latino characters, like Agamemnon, the macho host of the cable access show Naked Personalities, and 13-year-old local Louie, grateful he finally lost his virginity. Leguizamo's one-man show, Mambo Mouth, just came out on home video. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews David Byrne's new album. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United Nations Special Envoy to Yugoslavia, Cyrus Vance, is warning Serbs not to settle the Bosnian crisis by force, but units of the Serbian-dominated army have seized another town in the newly independent republic. Pierre Vickery reports.
The Belgrade-based news agency Tanjug said Serbian troops had taken control of the Bosnian border town of Bosanski Shamac after a night of heavy fighting. It said the town was now quiet and that tanks were patrolling the streets. The renewed Serbian offensive in Bosnia came as the United Nations Special Envoy, Cyrus Vance, completed his latest peace mission to the region. He said time for a settlement was running out, but expressed satisfaction that the warring factions had agreed to resume negotiations on a ceasefire and on settling the internal borders between Bosnia's three ethnic communities. The president of the European Commission, Jacques Delors, has sent a message of support to the Bosnian president. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
The lawyer for two Libyan men accused of blowing up Pan Am Flight 103 said today that they'd be willing to face trial abroad if they could be assured of a fair trial. Attorney Ibrahim Legwell said that the men would probably not be surrendered to the United States or Britain, the two nations that are demanding their extradition. Legwell told reporters in Tripoli that he was ready to turn his clients over to any other court that would meet conditions such as where the men would be held and what charges they'd be tried on. The UN Security Council has imposed an embargo on arms sales and air travel to Libya until it hands over the suspects. Both Christians and Jews are celebrating holy days in Jerusalem. Jews are marking Passover while Christians are commemorating Good Friday. Patricia Golan reports that tourists have returned to Israel in greater numbers this year than last because of last year's Persian Gulf War.
Ti adoriamo Cristo e ti benediciamo.
In the walled old city of Jerusalem today, tens of thousands of Christian pilgrims followed the Via Dolorosa, the way of the cross, the route Christ is believed to have walked to his crucifixion. Armed police lined the way as pilgrims sang hymns and carried wooden crosses along the 12 stations of the cross, but there were no incidents. The atmosphere this week is in marked contrast to a year ago when Christian pilgrims stayed away in the aftermath of the Gulf War and because of the Palestinian uprising. The Jewish festival of Passover begins this evening, which this year falls on the same weekend as Easter. During the seven-day holiday, Jews do not eat leavened bread, identifying with the Israelites who fled Egypt in such haste they had no time to let their bread rise. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
The holiday weekend may be remembered as the last gasp of winter over much of the country. Heavy snow fell in northern New England while thunderstorms rolled across the west and northwest. This is NPR. Officials in Chicago believe they're close to plugging the hole that allowed the Chicago River to flood more than 50 miles of tunnels and basements under the city's downtown loop. Today, workers poured quick-setting cement into a shaft in an effort to seal off the tunnel under the riverbed that burst on Monday. General Russell Furman of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers said that the plugging process probably won't be complete until Sunday. A two-day practice countdown at the Kennedy Space Center is over. NASA is preparing to launch the space shuttle Endeavour on its first flight. From member station WMFE, Dave Pignanelli reports.
The countdown demonstration test was completed late this morning with the simulated firing of Endeavour's main engines. The seven-member crew was on hand for the test and will return to Houston until the real countdown draws near. Endeavour was built to replace the shuttle Challenger, which was lost to an explosion in 1986. Endeavour's mission will include three spacewalks, one of which is to save a stranded satellite. Astronaut Pierre Thewitt will grab hold of the satellite and attach a rocket booster to it. Ground controllers will then fire the booster, sending the satellite into its proper orbit. The other two spacewalks will be used to practice techniques needed to assemble NASA's proposed space station Freedom. Liftoff is tentatively scheduled for the first week in May, but an exact launch date won't be announced until sometime next week. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
The nation's biggest issuer of Visa and MasterCards has announced that it will lower interest rates on some cards. Citibank said, well, it will reduce rates on its so-called preferred Visa or MasterCards from 16.8% to 13.9%. Nationwide, credit card interest rates average about 18%. Citibank has more than 30 million credit cards in circulation, and its move to lower rates is expected to set off reductions throughout the industry. Analysts said the rate cut may be designed to head off any further efforts in Congress to put a limit on credit card rates. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Going to Kansas City.
About 100 different singers recorded that song, from Wilbert Harrison, who had the original hit, to the Beatles and Sammy Davis Jr. My guests are the ones collecting the songwriting royalties, Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. This team has written many rock and roll classics for Elvis Presley, the Clovers, the Coasters, the Drifters, and Benny King. Their songs include Hound Dog, Jailhouse Rock, Yakety Yak, Poison Ivy, Searchin', and Stand By Me. They not only wrote the songs, they often produced them. In fact, Lieber and Stoller were the first rock and roll producers to actually get credit on the record for their work. Rock and roll's greatest producer, Phil Spector, got his start as Lieber and Stoller's assistants. Rhino Records has just released a CD of Lieber and Stoller's classic songs. It opens with the original 1953 recording of Hound Dog, sung by Big Mama Thornton. This was the first session Lieber and Stoller produced themselves.
You ain't nothing! Been snooping around my door. You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Been snooping around my door. You can wag your tail, but I ain't gonna feed you no more. You told me you was high class, but I can see through that. Yes, you told me you was high.
Jerry Lieber, Mike Stoller, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The record we've been listening to, Big Mama Thornton's recording of Hound Dog, was your first major hit as songwriters and producers. You wrote the song for her. What was it about her that led to this song?
Well, Mike and I were invited to Johnny Otis's rehearsal studio to listen to and look at some of his artists. Big Mama was one of them, and she was really formidable. She was scary looking. She was big, and she must have weighed about anywhere from 275 to 350, and she had this really guttural, growling sound in her voice. And the both of us fell in love with her, and we just loved what she looked like, and we loved what she sounded like. She sang Ball and Chain, and we decided to take off that minute and go to Mike's house and try to write something for her.
Well, how did you come up with this song, though?
Well, Mike was driving, and I was banging on the roof of the car, and I was trying to come up with something nasty that would be, at the same time, playable, that wouldn't be censored, you know? And the closest I could get to what I was thinking was, you ain't nothing but a hound dog.
So you were thinking four-letter word, epithet, and you came up with Hound Dog.
Right, which sort of, you know, made it felt right, and it seemed like it would be passable.
Mike, let me ask you how you think Elvis handled the song differently from Big Mama Thornton.
How he handled it differently? Yeah. Well, he handled it very differently. he didn't sing it in the same tradition of blues intonation that Big Mama used. And also, the lyrics were considerably different because Big Mama's, the way the song was written for Big Mama is really about a gigolo. It's a woman complaining about a gigolo. And Elvis couldn't sing that song. So he sang a version of it, which I think, as I'm told, he heard from a lounge act in Las Vegas, that he heard singing the song in Vegas. Now, I had heard that he knew Big Mama's record and loved it, but it was only after he heard this lounge act do it that it seemed appropriate for a male singer.
You know, I think it was the first time Elvis sang Hound Dog on TV. It was on the Steve Allen Show, and he sang it to a little hound dog. It was very cute.
A basset hound.
A basset hound, okay.
Right.
Did you feel really kind of cheated by that? Here's a song that you wrote that was supposed to be an epithet, you know, about a gigolo, and it ends up with someone as forceful as Elvis making it into, you know, this guy, cute little harmless song on the Steve Allen Show.
We thought it was kind of dopey.
Yeah.
I wasn't offended. I just thought it was silly, that's all.
Yeah. Now, you wrote several songs for Elvis, including Jailhouse Rock. Why don't we play a little bit of that?
Warden threw a party in the county jail. The prison band was there, they began to wail. The band was jumping and the joint began to swing. You should have heard this knocked-out jailbird sing. Let it rock, everybody, let it rock. Everybody in the old cell block.
Jailhouse Rock, written by my guests Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. Now, you wrote a lot of songs for Elvis's movies. This was really one of the best songs. Some of the movies had really awful songs in them. Did you have to write some of those awful songs?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Oh, we loved writing the awful songs because they were more fun. Things like Steadfast, Loyal and True, you know, songs when he was supposedly graduating high school. I don't think Elvis graduated high school, but maybe he did. But we had to write these terrible songs.
How'd you feel about having to write terrible songs? Why did you enjoy it?
Because it was funny.
Uh-huh.
It was amusing.
Yeah, it was kind of like anti-rock and roll.
Well, the thing was that the problem was this. You got a script, and there would be a moment in a scene where they would want a song. Now, we would tell the director, we would tell Hal Wallace, the producer, we'd say, look, you know, we're not trying to get out of writing a song, but this is really a dumb place for a song, you know? I mean, the guy's about to go into the boys' room and comb his hair, and I don't know why he has to sing, I'm going into the boys' room to comb my hair. And they'd say, we want the song. So we'd write it. So a lot of those songs that shouldn't have been written were written and recorded, and they're there for posterity.
A lot of the songs that you wrote over the years were novelty songs, songs like Charlie Brown, Love Potion Number 9, Yakety Yak, Poison Ivy. I think I just named all Coaster songs here. But how did you get so involved with novelty songs?
We didn't think of them as novelties.
We thought of them dark dramas. We were both trying to imitate Tolstoy and Dickens, and I guess we just fell short of the mark. We wrote novelty songs because we're both essentially gag writers, and we like to tell funny stories and anecdotes. And this is just a way of telling funny stories set to music.
Well, let me play one of your novelty songs that's on the Rhino Records anthology that's just been released of some of your songs. And this is Charlie Brown.
Feet, feet, five, five, four, four, four. I smell smoke in the auditorium.
Everybody always picking on me.
That's him on his knees.
I was wondering if one of the reasons why you wrote so many novelty songs is had to do with that you were two white Jews writing for a lot of R&B groups who were black. I don't know how self-conscious you were about that. But I was thinking, well, maybe it was easier in a way to write songs that were funny as opposed to maybe the presumptuousness of writing something that was really heartfelt when you were writing for other people. Though you wrote a lot of those songs, too.
Well, to begin with, these two white Jews really experienced themselves as black. I was brought up in an essentially predominantly black neighborhood in South Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And Stoller can speak for himself, but he went to interracial camps when he was a kid. No, it's not that. We really felt that we were very black, and we acted black, and we spoke black. And it wasn't really till later on, when you hear these later songs, like 1959 and 60, the Late Coasters things,
mm-hmm.
that are really kind of generalized rock and roll for mass market. But the early stuff that we wrote things like, our early songs were not really novelty. They were blues. Hound Dog is a buck dance blues for Big Mama. And Kansas City is a 12-bar blues, certainly not a novelty song. All the early stuff with Jimmy Witherspoon.
And Hard Times that we wrote for Charles Brown.
These are all blues. And we wrote essentially, not essentially, we wrote exclusively for black artists because that's how we felt. And it wasn't until later on that we started to stretch a little bit and when we moved actually from L.A. to New York, started to write for a broader market.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. And if you're just joining us, my guest is the songwriting and production team of Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. And Rhino Records has just brought out a new collection of some of their rock classics. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller are my guests. Now, after you were writing songs for a while, you started producing the records of the people who were doing your songs. This was in the days before record producers were considered to be the auteurs of, you know, of the music industry. What was your approach when you walked in the studio? What did you take control of when you were producing a session?
Everything. From the song, the artist, interpretation, the arrangement, the sound, everything.
Selection of the musicians. Mike essentially picked all the musicians, handpicked the musicians, and did the bones of all the arrangements and played piano on all the record dates, or at least all the great ones. And I was essentially responsible for the performance of the singers.
Singers, right.
And I directed the singers. We worked that way for 40 years, I guess. We're still working that way.
Why did you get into the production? Why did you want that control?
Well, self-defense, really.
We needed to protect the intention of our work because we had had a few experiences early on where we would deliver a song on a piece of paper and it didn't come out the way we had intended it at all. It was another aesthetic entirely.
Give me an example.
And in order to make it sound the way we planned to make it, we had to do it ourselves.
For instance, we'd come in with what we thought was like a sort of a Texas shuffle, you know, a blues,
mm-hmm.
and it would be on paper, and we didn't have a demo, and they would turn it over. Because we were somewhat hot, they'd take it that way, and they would turn it over to an A&R man, say at Capitol or at CBS, whatever. And these were good producers, but they had their own sense of what was correct and what was happening, and they weren't down into rhythm and blues. They were still rooted in swing and jazz at that time. And they would, you know, we would have something that should sound like either a Texas pickup band or Memphis Slim. And they would make a record that would sound like Tommy Dorsey or Benny Goodman's swing band. And it would just be wrong. And so after a couple of these disappointments, we decided to, in self-defense, to learn how to produce records ourselves so we could make our songs come off the way they were intended.
One of the things that you are famous for having pioneered was bringing a string section to rock and roll or to rhythm
that
and blues.
That was Mike's fault.
Yeah, let me ask you, you know, on the Drifters recording of There Goes My Baby, that's the classic example of you bringing strings on. What went through your mind to do it?
I can tell you exactly what was on my mind. Just the line, the melodic line. And I was playing it. I used to joke about this one because it sounded like Borodin and I sounded like one of the Caucasian melodies. And
I don't know if you get the pun, but he's been saying this for many years, and I always thought it was funny.
Right.
The fact that he would use a Caucasian melody on this
But it was, Jerry heard it, and he said, that sounds like strings. And I said, why not? And so why not? We had five violins and one cello, and they were all basically playing in unison.
Because Jerry Wexler wouldn't spring for six violins and two celli.
Was it hard to find string players who could play with the right spirit on a session with the Drifters?
No, they didn't have to play with the right spirit. They just had to play a Caucasian melody. And so we hired a lot of Caucasian string players.
Now, another thing that happened on this record was you introduced a Latin rhythm that you used.
The Bayonne rhythm was one that both Jerry and I adored. It was I first heard it in the film Anna with Silvana Mangano. And they had a small Brazilian group. And the record Anna became a fairly big hit, and it was a popular melody. And I just loved the rhythm on it. And we had always looked for a place to use it. We'd used it maybe once before on a early record that was not particularly successful. And we had the opportunity to use it on this record date. And there happened to be a timpani left over from another recording session in the studio. And we used it. Now, the drummer was not a percussionist. He was just a trap drummer, and he didn't know how to use the tuning pedal on the timp. So he played one note throughout the entire thing, which gave it a rather bizarre, muddy bottom with all kinds of weird overtones. It was kind of fascinating, though. And that's where we first had a successful use of that Bayonne rhythm, which, in case anybody's wondering, is boom, 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 boom.
Which finally was used, I think, and is responsible for maybe over 1,000 hits, because this Brazilian rhythm supports a slow ballad without the ballad seeming to be slow or sluggish. It keeps it moving, and everyone from Burt Bacharach to Phil Spector to you name it, have leaned heavily on the support of this rhythm pattern.
My guests are the songwriting and production team of Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. Are you still writing songs together?
And apart. Yes, we are.
Yeah.
How often do you see each other?
Too often. We see each other about twice a week.
So
sometimes three times a week. We talk every day.
So you still have a close working relationship?
Absolutely.
You were saying that you really thought of yourselves as being black when you were writing for black R&B groups early on. When did that change? When did you start thinking, well, I guess I'm really not black. I'm really white. And when was there a point in your careers when you started thinking that it was presumptuous to think of yourselves as being black when in fact you were white?
I don't really remember when it happened. I don't really remember when the transition, I don't think it was abrupt. I think it was gradual.
Uh-huh.
And because you see, when I was a kid growing up, it was where I came from, it was hip to be black, you know? I mean, to be white was kind of square, you know? And the clothes, you know, you had to dress a certain way. And if you looked a certain way and you spoke a certain way, then you were okay. And if you didn't, then you were lame. And all, you know, teenagers especially are very, very conscious about what is hip and what is lame and what is square and what is out and what is in, you know? And, I mean, I grew up right there in the middle of a black culture, and I knew dead on what it was, you know? I mean, firsthand.
And I belonged to a social club in Harlem from the time I was 13 years old, and I used to go up there every weekend. And from there, of course, I used to hang out on 52nd Street and listen to all the jazz musicians in the little clubs. So that was a part of my life.
When I met Stoller, he was sporting a goatee and he was wearing a beret, and he would stand hunched over like he had a humpback, and he'd smoking, and he would say, you say anything to him, you say, you want to go to the movies? He'd say, Or you say, you hungry, man? Let's go eat. He'd go, Because he was like that, right? It wasn't until he was about 21 that he started talking.
So let me ask you again, if there was a point when you started thinking that it was presumptuous to think of yourselves as being black.
I think when Baraka turned to me one day, because Leroy Jones had been my buddy for years, and Leroy in New York told me that I was the greatest living black songwriter. This was when he was Leroy Jones. And about 2 or 3 years later, when the revolution started to happen, right, he informed me that I was white.
How did you respond?
I sort of felt like I'd been betrayed.
I think he was astonished to find out.
I started sitting in the front of the bus.
I haven't asked you, what is your style of working together? Let me go back to when you were writing hits nearly every day. What was your style of working together? Would you be in the same room?
We'd be in the same bathrobes. We were matching bathrobes. Yeah, we'd be in the same room. Actually, Stoller would normally sit at the piano, and I would sort of stalk around the room and smoke. Now, neither of us smoke anymore, so it's taken half the fun out of work. But he would sit at the piano and fiddle, and finally, I don't mean fiddle. I mean fiddle with a piano, you fool.
And Lieber would stalk around the room screaming.
Right.
And if something stuck to the wall, something he screamed, we work on it.
We take a biopsy and work. But now that was the early days. The way we work these days, when we work, I usually have a fix on a lyric, and I'll bring in 8 or 10 or 12 lines, and I'll give it to Mike, and he'll go home and work on it, because this way we can have some time alone.
And it's is a delight. I will write a melody or half a melody and lay it on Jerry and say, listen, what can you do with this? And then we'll get back together and tear it apart and start over.
Well, we're out of time. I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thanks.
Righto. Yeah, it was fun.
That collection of some of the classic songs of Lieber and Stoller is on Rhino Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. John Leguizamo's one-man show, Mambo Mouth, is a satirical look at Latino life in America. It's been an off-Broadway hit, an HBO special. Now it's out on video. Coming up, John Leguizamo on creating his gallery of characters, like the macho host of a cable access show, a tough-talking transvestite, and a sex-obsessed teenager. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews David Byrne's new album, Uh-Oh. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Mujahideen rebels in Afghanistan are closing in on Kabul, the capital. Reports say a senior minister has left the city to meet with rebel commander Ahmad Shah Massoud, reportedly the most powerful of the rebel leaders. Chris Bowers filed this report for the BBC.
Commander Massoud has an unrivaled reputation among the ranks of the Mujahideen. An astute political and military leader, his battles against Soviet troops earned him the epithet the Lion of the Panjshir. Across Afghanistan over the last 2 months, much of the north, including the second city, has come under the control of a coalition of rebel Mujahideen and key government commanders. The Mujahideen are now gathering in the area in large numbers, coordinating strategy and making detailed military preparations. They were in jubilant mood. Against that scenario stands the United Nations peace process. UN officials are continuing frantic negotiations with anyone who will speak to them. The question for most Afghans in the capital will be how further bloodshed can be avoided.
Chris Bowers reporting. Serbia has accused the United States and European countries of waging an unscrupulous campaign against its government. It has also invited world governments to send officials to see the Yugoslav situation for themselves. This statement is in response to a declaration by the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe that condemned Serbia and the Serb-led Yugoslav army for violating the territorial integrity of the newly independent state of Bosnia. Crews in Chicago are still working around the clock trying to stop flooding in an underground tunnel system beneath the city's business district. From member station WBEZ, David Shaper reports.
Crews are no longer trying to plug the leak where the Chicago River has been pouring into an old freight tunnel system 40 feet below the Chicago Loop. They are now trying to seal off that part of the tunnel that collapsed from the rest of the system. Divers are helping pour quick-drying concrete in place, and Chicago Mayor Richard Daley says crews will be working all weekend and maybe into next week just to seal off that leak.
It will be some time before business and commerce in the Loop area returns to normal. Right now, none of us can say when this will be over. And I want you and all the people of Chicago to be prepared for what's ahead.
At least 35 buildings still have water in their basements and sub-basements. The subway is closed indefinitely, and the loss to the city and its businesses is already estimated to be over $1 billion. For National Public Radio, I'm David Shaper in Chicago.
Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan tried to calm fears that the sharp drop in the Japanese stock market will harm the United States market. He told the Senate Banking Committee today any impact from the falling Nikkei is likely to be limited. Tokyo stocks have plummeted by at least 30% since last October. Wall Street investors seem to be taking his advice. The Dow Jones Industrials closed at record highs 3 days this week. The market was closed today in observance of Good Friday. This is NPR. A former supervisor at the House Post Office was charged today with cocaine possession and conspiring to cover up embezzlement at the post office. Dorothea Riesenhoover was charged in a two-count criminal information today. That means a defendant has waived his or her right to have the case presented to a federal grand jury, and the defendant is expected to plead guilty. Ms. Riesenhoover is charged with conspiring to cover up missing stamps and money from the post office and from clerk Wendell Magruder. Magruder is charged with selling crack cocaine and marijuana to fellow post office workers. In California, attorneys for convicted murderer Robert Alton Harris are asking a court to intervene in his pending execution on the grounds that death by lethal gas is cruel and unusual punishment. From member station KQED, Betsy Bea reports.
Yesterday, Governor Pete Wilson denied Harris's petition for clemency, clearing the way for his execution next Tuesday. Attorney Michael Lawrence of the American Civil Liberties Union says California's use of cyanide gas in the execution chamber is barbaric.
The effect of introducing cyanide into the human body is to cause one to suffocate slowly. A person who is subject to cyanide gas will go through extreme pain, a pain which would last anywhere from upwards to 10 to 15 minutes.
Harris was sentenced to death for killing two San Diego teenagers in 1978. His attorneys have also asked the state Supreme Court to intervene in the case, citing new evidence about the crime. If the appeals are denied, Harris will become the first person executed in California in 25 years. For National Public Radio, I'm Betsy Bea in San Francisco.
President and Mrs. Bush are taking a long Easter weekend at their vacation home in Kennebunkport, Maine. They attended a brief Good Friday service today in the chilly northeast town. It was blanketed overnight by a spring snowstorm. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When actor John Leguizamo was starting out, some people told him to try and pass for white, not to limit himself to being Hispanic. He says he had to prove to everyone that being Hispanic wasn't limiting. So Leguizamo created Mambo Mouth, a one-man show featuring a gallery of Latino characters. Mambo Mouth was an off-Broadway hit. It was adapted for HBO, and now it's out on home video. The characters range from Pepe, a Mexican who tries to keep from getting deported by attempting to pass for Swedish, Irish, and Jewish, to Agamemnon, the macho host of the public access talk show Naked Personalities.
Let's start the show, as we always do, by reading letters from women that want to be loved by me around the world. And this first letter is from a woman that wants to be loved by me in El Salvador. Nice little underdeveloped country. And it says, "Dear Mr. Agamemnon," she repeats me, "I am a Republican single Hispanic woman. Please come to my rescue. Invade me, blockade me, dictate me." I didn't see that it continued. "Spill your oils on my virginal beaches. Deplete me of my natural resources. Be mine forever, yours in Christ, Mimosa."
I think it's great the way you could do characters who are so physically different. You know, you do this real macho Agamemnon talk show host, and then you do Manny the Fanny, who's a transvestite.
That's right, Cindy Crawford's better looking sister. That's right. You better talk to me, girl. What you got to problem? Tell me, go ahead, talk to me.
Where did you get the clothes, the speech, and the body language from? Or was this based on somebody in particular?
Well, the emotional life. See, all my characters are like a collage effect, you know. It's like they come from all kinds of inspirations. I mean, I felt that the soulful part of it was my mom, and then she spoke like my cousin, Mirtha. And then I modeled the physicality on this transvestite called Sassy that I went downtown and researched. Downtown New York is a 14th Street in the meat market, if anybody wants to go do some more research. And this transvestite named Sassy, that was her nickname. And she just talked to me, and she was dancing on the street and telling me about how she wears flat shoes so nobody comes and beats up so she could run away, because if she wore high heels, they would kill her.
Another character you do is Loco Louie, and in this sketch he loses his virginity. Well, he's telling a friend about losing his virginity with a fat prostitute, right. And he's bragging about how he's become a man, but the experience was actually very confusing and disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
Who is this based on?
Well, I'm not going to tell you exactly who it's based on, but you can probably guess. I mean, the reason I created that character was, I mean, I was like that crazed little kid, you know, and I know a lot of Latin people have these wild personalities. They're really funny, and I love so much. And so I give that as a tribute to that. But the whole story that he tells of losing his sexuality was because when I was 13 and 12, as a matter of fact, sex was already so important, and I noticed that in white culture it wasn't so important. I mean, 13-year-old white kids aren't so obsessed with having sex. I mean, talking about it and sneaking maybe Playboys, but I mean, because I guess you grew up in the inner city. I'm talking about inner city life. And you don't have that much toys. You don't travel to Europe on weekends. You know what I'm saying? You don't have all these distractions. The only few things you have are sports and sex. You know what I'm saying? So it's like sex became such an important issue in my life. You know, because all my friends had it, or they were telling me they had it. and I'm sure some of them did have it, so that it became really important. People were dating, and we were, you know, we were having spin the bottle, playing dentist, and turn off the lights and fill up the girl parties, you know. And we were only 13. So, I mean, that's what it was. It was so important to us to have it, and that's why this kid brags about it, makes such a big deal about it. And to have sex, regardless of how much he was in love or not in love, was not the issue. It was just to have sex and be able to say that I had it. I'm a man. I belong. I'm coming of age.
So should I ask you if you lost it with a prostitute?
Well, I lost it before that. I lost it when I was 13, if you could call it losing it. I wasn't sure. I didn't finish the whole act, so I don't know if you... I was pushed off. So I don't know if I finished it. But I guess that's losing it. And then I almost lost it again. And then I finally did lose it with a prostitute when I was a little older.
Well, this character, this Loco Louie character that you do, he feels like, well, now he's really got it. Now he's really a man. So he's hananging on the corner, you know, making...
screaming it out at all his friends or anybody who cares to listen.
Yeah, and making kissing noises at the women who go by and saying, like, hey, baby, how about a little tongue drill? did you do that kind of stuff on the corner?
I did that kind of stuff. And kids still do it. And I'm amazed when I see a 10-year-old doing that because, you know, especially... inner-city street kids. I mean, there's Latin people come in so many different factions, and I'm not talking about all Latin people. I'm talking about certain types of people and types that I related to. And yeah, you know, it was, my ex-girlfriend was walking down the street, and all these little 10-year-old kids were making all these comments at her, and she was just cracking up, you know? I mean, some women are offended by those kind of comments, but I just find that, I don't know. I think it depends, you know. I think guys are showing their appreciation of a woman, but nowadays it would be sexual harassment, right?
Well, it doesn't always feel like an appreciation when you're the woman walking by and someone's making those kissing noises at you.
Yeah, I guess it's tough.
So
I won't be doing it anytime soon.
Yeah,
right?
No, I want you to stop doing that, John.
All right, it's just me in every corner. If you hear, ay, mami, mira, it's me, all right? And I'm just joking.
Now, you tried acting before doing Mambo Mouth. I mean, you did act before.
I tried acting. What are you getting at,
Terry? It didn't come out right.
You think I failed or something? Should I try again? Yeah, no.
Until you get it right, John.
All right, I will. I promise. I will be trying. Seriously.
What kind of roles were you getting before Mambo Mouth? I know you did Casualties of War.
Right, which was a pretty interesting role, especially for a Latin person, because I wasn't a drug dealer. I wasn't... a scam artist. I wasn't a junkie or cleaning somebody's house or an illegal alien. So that was unique in that sense. The only problem I had with the role was that it was so underwritten, I felt, you know? Because being Latin, you become too representative for all of Latin people. You know, when I write my pieces, all of a sudden, it's like if Eugene O'Neill, to pick anybody at the top of my head, wrote Long Day's Journey to Night, and that was representative of all white people, there would be so many people being on his case going, well, my mother wasn't a junkie. My father's not an alcoholic. How dare you? But that's what happens with Latin work, is that it becomes overly symbolic and representative of all Latin people, and it can't possibly be. It can only be my Latin experience. And so when I act sometimes, I take that burden on myself, I guess voluntarily, being the masochist that I am. That when I did Casualties, I just felt, God, it was so underwritten, and he was the one that was two-faced and wasn't strong enough, couldn't talk up for himself. So that kind of bothered me.
My guest is John Leguizamo. His one-man show, Mambo Mouth, just came out on home video. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Actor and writer John Leguizamo is my guest. Now, I'm interested in finding out more about you. You were born in Colombia?
Well, I'm not going to tell you. Go ahead. I dare you. I was born in Colombia. So what? Yeah, I'm defensive. What's up, woman? No, yeah, I was born in Colombia, and I came here when I was 4 years old, and then my parents followed. See, I was very innovative.
Well, what made your family decide to move to the States?
I guess lack of opportunities and and problems. My dad has Puerto Rican ascendancy, so they have, I'm half Puerto Rican, half Colombian. But they came here because it was just difficult. My dad had a whole bunch of jobs in South America, and it just, like, he was a very ambitious man, and he wanted to be a film director when he was 19 years old and studied for it, but, you know, there was just no opportunities in Latin America. I mean, that's one great thing about America, and even if I put it down sometimes or have a lot of problems, only to make it better, because this is truly the greatest country in the world. I mean, I feel that America is really a land of opportunity, and my parents came here with nothing and worked their culos off. That means their buns in Spanish, just to make something, and they were able to make something of themselves, even though it was a big struggle, and there was a lot of racism and stuff involved. You can still work through it.
What did your parents end up doing professionally?
My father owns some real estate, and my mom, she was a business manager at a German bank.
Mm-hmm.
She handled Latin affairs stuff. But my father, I mean, when they first came here, my father had two jobs in restaurants, and he tried to pass himself off as Italian so that he wouldn't have to be washing dishes in the kitchen, because he was light-skinned enough and his features were passing enough so that he could pass for Italian. And so he'd tell them that he was Italian and fake an Italian accent. I guess that's where I got my acting skill from surviving. And then he'd get waitering jobs so he could make more money. And then he'd have two of those jobs or three of them sometimes. I hardly saw my father that much when I was growing up. And then my mom worked at a doll factory for a while, and then she became a receptionist and then a secretary. And she moved away. I worked really hard. I come from a very workaholic-type family.
When your father was passing for Italian, did that used to eat away at him when he came home?
I don't think so. Not my father. I don't want to talk about him anymore, because it's hard. No, it didn't eat away at him. I mean, I think my father had a lot of shame with him. He's always had a lot of shame, I mean, about his accent, and he'd assume, and I assume sometimes that when you go to restaurants and you're given, even my aunt, my family, you just can't help it. You go to restaurants and you're given, like, this weird, funky table all the way in the back. You think it's because of who you are, because of your ethnicity, because you're Latin, and they dislike you. But sometimes I don't think it's that, you know?
Sometimes it's just the only table left.
Yeah, sometimes it is only table, and sometimes it is racism. It's just, and it's so hard to be able to sometimes put away and just be objective and take each moment as it is. But sometimes you just carry on that burden with you, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, I read about you that you, when you decided you wanted to act, you tried to find an acting school from the phone book.
I did. My fingers did the walking, and I went to the Yellow Pages, and I found this place called Sylvia Lee Showcase Theater. I said, Showcase, that sounds good. And I went there, and I studied with this lady who thought she was Vivian Lee, doing Streetcar Named Desire. Sweetest little lady. And she took me and took my money, and actually, the first scene I did, I was amazingly incredible. I mean, I said, damn, boy, I'm seriously talented. And I did it, and I got some people from NYU. I was 17, and some NYU people wanted to do films with me and whatnot. But then every scene I did after that was so bad, I didn't understand what happened. And that's when I continued acting for the rest of my life and pursuing it.
So was the school helpful at all?
It was, totally was. I mean, to have studied, and she worked real hard on my diction and my speech, because she said, you know, don't limit yourself. You can be so many other things. Don't limit yourself with your accent and things like that, which happened to me a lot in my career. I auditioned for Juilliard, and I guess I wasn't Elizabethan enough. It was kind of hard in Jackson Heights when everybody talks, hey, yo, what's up, man, what's up? But I did some, I took out records from Sir John Gielgud and tried, is this a dagger which I see before me? The handle taught, and I did it just like the record did at the audition. And this lady said, excuse me, but you have a too thick a New York City minority accent. I said, and what do you have, lady? A Long Islandese accent, perhaps? And she said, you're very talented, but you just have an accent, and we can't put you in Juilliard. But I still struggled. I never gave up.
I have one last question for you. Some people have criticized Mambo Mouth for having like stereotypical characters. What do you say to that?
I mean, I feel, first of all, Mambo Mouth had some sense of stereotyping, because it took prototypes that are in the media that I was accosted with, that I had to deal with all the time in terms of casting, and also with there were characters that I also loved. So I took these one-dimensional things and made them as three-dimensional as possible. and injecting them with the real life that is so lacking when I see them on television and the movies. And that's what I did with that. It was like, my mom was an exorcism for me, a purge of all that. And comedy is based on a lot of recognition. And I feel, first and foremost, I am trying to do a comedy. And when Latin people can mock themselves and we can mock our image and who we are, I feel it's a great step to moving on to other areas, you know?
Yeah.
And there was the majority of Latin people who did come to see the show loved it to death. And they would tell me, oh, yo, man, I know so many people like that. I grew up in Jackson Heights. I know all those people. Oh, man, I know those transvestites from Vaseline Alley, an actual place in Jackson Heights. So, I mean, they're taken from real life. And if people just feel like these are the exact representation of Latin people, it's because they have aspirations to being something else and they want that Bill Cosby Latin experience, which I can't write about because it ain't mine. You know?
Well, John, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Always a pleasure, Terry. Next time I'll do the same thing.
Okay.
Goodbye, mommy. Meet up.
John Leguizamo's one-man show Mambo Mouth just came out on home video. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we are watching a couple of places in the world where things appear about to happen. The city of Kabul in Afghanistan, where Mujahideen guerrillas are poised to enter the city, and Libya, which is trying to decide how to react to United Nations sanctions. We'll also be asking who pays for the damages caused in the Chicago flood. We'll look at what is going to happen when Russia renames itself. Also, a feature on vice presidential busts, on an explorer, an early explorer of Tibet, and a teacher who eats worms.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For the past few years, former talking head David Byrne has been putting out music on his own label, Luwaka Bop. He produced several collections of South American and Cuban music, as well as an album of his own music called Ray Momo. Now David Byrne has a new solo album called Uh-Oh. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Uh-Oh, David Byrne has made what I think will stand as the cutest album of the year. Certainly that song, Girls on My Mind, is a cunning little thing, perky and simple-minded, where we usually expect Byrne to be self-consciously arty. Byrne recently gave a few interviews confirming what everyone has pretty much assumed, that Talking Heads has really broken up, and there's even a certain amount of animosity now between Byrne and the rest of the band. I can only imagine that they'll be even more cheesed off when they hear this album. It represents the first time in Byrne's solo career that he's really tried to echo the angular urgency of vintage Talking Heads music.
And now Washington, D.C.'s a funny little town. The further you look into it, the further things stick out. You ought to be ashamed. You ought to be destroyed. I'll chuck you into little bits and feed you to my dogs.
Over the course of Uh-Oh, Byrne has fun with serious ideas and gets serious about having fun. A dad offers his child a chipper explanation of his recent sex change operation in the song Now I'm Your Mom. And in other places here, Byrne tells a scary campfire story, imagines cowboys doing the mambo on lonely prairie nights, and chatters on about how much fun it is to hang out in your neighborhood mall. In every case, the music is cheery, catchy, simple. It's fun, but it's also so self-conscious that it comes out a bit stiff.
Twisted sister, don't you miss it. There's 100 more where she came from.
Wiggle, wiggle,
jiggle, jiggle.
Jesus,
the babes are almost grown. And I don't need to watch the news at night. Anyone can see we're out of time. Hanging on, hanging out. Got my $100 shoes. Hanging round, hanging free. And we got nothing else to do. What goes up, it must come down. Oh, she took another dose. Hanging out, hanging free. Till her mama takes us home.
In an essay published recently in the New Republic, the writer Tad Friend lumped Byrne in with other artists like David Lynch, Laurie Anderson, Martin Amis, and Jonathan Demme, saying that they, quote, all rummage through lowbrow art as dispassionately as they would through a clothes hamper, fascinated by unsorted Americana. Friend's point is that Byrne and the others all fancy themselves highbrows who traffic in pop culture only with irony and disdain. And as Friend says, art that is only slumming has no claim on greatness. I think much of that is accurate, but I also think that with an album like Uh-Oh, greatness is the furthest thing from David Byrne's mind. I think that after four solo albums that didn't sell very well, this is one talking head who's out to beef up his bank account and the hell with art. The fact that this possible cynicism has inspired some good songs ought to tell him something. Cuteness suits you, Dave.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
It's a tiny town, and you can hang around with everybody knows what you've been doing. So don't you mess around, it's a tiny town.
Teeny weeny town, tiny town, tiny town.
And every little town, if you look around, is a tiny town, tiny town, tiny town. Be careful, my darling, what you say.
We'd love to hear your comments about Fresh Air. Call our toll-free listener line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. That's 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Thad Kirk, and Orji Voblaitis. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. We all wish you a happy Easter and a good Passover. I'm Terry Gross.
Town, but we have trouble living with each other.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, I married a communist. I was a communist for the FBI and other Red Scare relics. We talk with Michael Barson. His new book, Better Dead Than Red, looks at how popular culture fueled public hysteria during the Cold War. Also, we talk with writer Annie Dillard. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.